Welcome to Authors on Tour Live, a weekly podcast for people who love to hear about books from the authors themselves. Presented by Belco Credit Union. Visit www.belco.org/authors.asp to learn more about how Belco can help you. My name is Darren Fote, and today we are podcasting live from the Tattered Cover Bookstore, one of the premier independent bookstores in the nation, with three locations in the Metro Denver area. You can visit www.authorsontourlive.com for a complete list of upcoming podcasts. Wait a minute, it's time to begin.
Good evening, and welcome to the Tattered Cover. I want to thank you all for coming tonight, and thank you for your support of Tattered Cover and other independent bookstores around the country. Here tonight to introduce our honored guest and author is John DeLaSalle, the board president for the Denver Metropolitan affiliate of Susan G. Komen for The Cure. Please join me in welcoming John DeLaSalle.
Thank you. Thanks for being here tonight. We really appreciate your support, and we know that on a Monday night, your time is valuable, so thank you. Our very special guest tonight is known around the world for the work that has defined her life for the last 30 years. Since 1980, when her sister, Susan G. Komen, died of breast cancer at the age of 36. Before she died, Susie asked her sister Nancy to promise to do whatever she could to end the devastation of breast cancer. And 2 years later, Nancy did by founding the Susan G. Komen Breast Cancer Foundation with the mission of ending breast cancer forever. Today, Nancy is the CEO of Susan G. Komen for the Cure. Excuse me. And she has been the U.S. ambassador to Hungary and the U.S. chief of protocol. She's also been awarded the Presidential Medal of Freedom. And today, as Goodwill Ambassador for Cancer Control with the United Nations, she is leading the global campaign to address the global crisis for cancer. In the three decades since the promise, Nancy has built Susan G. Komen for the Cure into the world's largest breast cancer organization, which is active in 50 countries and has invested more than $1.5 billion into research and programs that help support women that have been diagnosed with breast cancer. Millions participate in this movement around the world every day. And what amazes me is that Nancy makes it seem so easy, but as we all know, this has been a long road. Nancy has been a pioneer, and she, with her global team, have really helped make the advances towards finding the cures for breast cancer. Nancy has written her incredible story in a memoir that is heartbreaking and hilarious, inspiring and educational. It is a love story, a business primer, and breast education handbook. And most of all, it's a story about how one person can indeed make the world, change the world for the better. And I think we're all better people and more aware for the promise that Nancy made to her sister 30 years ago. And, you know, I have to say, Nancy is just an incredible person. She's generous, heartfelt, just a real advocate for the people. And she's just truly inspiring. And so with that, I'd like to introduce you to Ambassador Nancy G. Brinker.
Thank you. I want to thank everybody at the affiliate. John, you did a great job. Michelle, the race chairs, thank you so much again. What an amazing, amazing. How many of you were at the race? Yeah, it was great. 52,000? Yeah. Well, I am very delighted to be here and looking forward to it. I think this is a great bookstore. Thank you for inviting me. It's really, I wish I had time to just browse around here. But it's a thrill to be here in Denver. This, I think, is our fourth largest affiliate out of 120 in the United States. And we're so proud of the work that's done here. You know, just from the race yesterday, 36 projects were funded that basically fund the needs and services for low-resource people who would never have treatment before. And, you know, many, many, many of these folks haven't seen a physician since maybe their last child was delivered, if they saw a physician then. So this is an opportunity for them to interact with the healthcare system and be treated. And when people criticize us for too much pink, and I'm sure some people yesterday in Denver thought, oh, they see any more pink. But the fact is, these events are very important for helping this community and also helping us translate what we've invested in for so many years. That is the research and making sure that we are really ending death by breast cancer and at least allowing people with advanced disease to live longer. Our ultimate goal is to learn what's causing it and then to learn how to prevent it. But by the end of the decade, we're very excited. Now, let me just talk for a minute about the book. And then I really want to hear your questions, and I'd like to do some Q&A with you. The publisher called me about a year and a half ago and wanted to know if I wanted to do a memoir, and we were working with William Morris out of New York. And I said, well, I'm not sure I wanted, you know, a memoir. I think you do that when you're really old. And those of you here who heard me say this before, I am really old all of a sudden. I looked around and I thought it's time, because my sister's name now sits on top of the largest global leader in the fight against breast cancer. And yet, so much time has gone by that people didn't really know her or didn't understand why it was so important for me to live this promise this many years, and hence to be so dedicated to the Susan G. Komen for the cure. And it's been an amazing and a glorious opportunity and journey, and a bittersweet one, because I see so many people every year lose their lives. On the other hand, I'm seeing a lot fewer people doing that right away. People are living longer, and she would have been very grateful for that. But she was only 36 when she died, and she really, really wanted to see an end to this disease, and she asked me to do that. So that's what really this book is about. The promise made to my sister, the growth of Susan G. Komen over the years, with wonderful stories of survivors, some you may recognize, because a lot of survivor stories really have a lot of similarities. And then a history of breast cancer, because a lot of people in America don't understand that, you know, not too much was done before about 40 years ago. And before then, the treatment was very mutilating, if people ever could get treatment. And it was so scary, that's why there was such an absolute silence around it. And, you know, it was the big C. It wasn't breast cancer. And it couldn't be spoken of on TV, print, newspapers, radios, whatever. Just people couldn't talk about it out loud. But the worst problem was that people who were diagnosed with the disease couldn't talk about it. So this organization has offered people that, and I hope that this book offers the public and a lot of people even a greater opportunity to feel that we really have their backs. We really understand this disease. We are the people who have made the greatest change and will continue to do so. It was very bittersweet writing this book. I have a very talented writer that I've worked with, Joni Rogers, whose name is also with me, who is also a cancer survivor. And so it was an experience both of us had to relive our own cancer. I, too, am a breast cancer survivor 3 years after my sister died. And it was an experience that we both had about reliving how you feel going through a diagnosis like breast cancer. And Joni, in the book, even talks about Rituxan, which she had non-Hodgkin's lymphoma. So she talks a lot about how the research we'd done at Susan G. Komen actually was the drug that she had been given in her therapy and that saved her life 12 years ago. So we had a connection right away. And then the process of going through all the pictures and the letters and the diaries and deciding what we could put in these pages and what we needed to exclude was also a bit of a painful experience, because you think everything's important. In fact, it isn't. And yet I hope that what we've put in this book and written will have a long life and will help a lot of people. So I guess that I think the most important thing for me personally, though, is that this book really tells who my sister was, the kind of person she was. A great beauty, but a great, generous human being with an enormously big heart who had the foresight to believe that this could be done. We grew up in the era of polio, which was the scariest epidemic of our youth. And that's the model that I used when we went to design Susan G. Komen for the Cure in my living room with 12 nice but unwilling volunteers and a shoebox full of names and $200. And we set about deciding we were going to cure this disease, much to everyone else's chagrin. No one believed we could do it. No one thought we would stick with it. But we did. And a year later, Race for the Cure came about. And then after that, everything started happening. It took us, however, about 10 years to be accepted, to have real cause-related marketing partners, people that we could actually depend on to help us sponsor events. You know, it just wasn't, again, really acceptable to a lot of people to have the word breast cancer in an organization and accept it as something that people could talk about. So over the years, we've made a cultural change, and we've also made a huge change in the clinic and in research. But all this ties back to my sister's life and to our family life. And it was a great joy to write, and I'm very excited about it. I think I'm hoping that people, you know, enjoy it, and I want them to communicate with me, with Susan G. Komen, and, you know, do what I can to continue the promise. Does anyone have any questions? Because I'd like to hear what's on your mind. Yes.
Did you ever feel like giving up?
Oh, I felt like giving up.
Especially with
yeah. At least three times I seriously considered that I just couldn't do it anymore. And one time was about 8 years after we started, and I just didn't feel like I could. It was just so hard to do it, you know. And then my father, who never quite understood what I was doing anyway, because he always wanted me to be a lawyer and he understood business, but he didn't quite understand what we were doing with all those pink ribbons. And he said to me, you know, Nan, it's hard, but it's not that you have a bad idea, but remember, and it's not that most people have bad ideas, it's that they quit. And my father was a bit of a perfectionist, so I thought about that long and hard, and I thought, what happens if I quit and we just don't do this? And, you know, and something always happened in moments like that that just turned, and the next day I was right back at it. But that hasn't happened for many years, because in 1991, when we had our first Race for the Cure in Washington, I knew that finally we were going to be of a scalable size, that we would begin to, if we worked really hard over the next decade and a half, we would begin to be like we are now. And that has taken thousands of people a lot of work, not just me. So, yes. Well, you know, two things. My sister loved pink, and she was homecoming queen at our house, at our high school. And she had this dress that had a pink ribbon down the front, and she just loved that dress, and I'll never forget it. And then, really, when we were creating the foundation, the fear was so enormous. It was just permeating the culture. People couldn't really talk about it. And so the organizations that did exist, and the government, and the physicians, you know, would give you this printed material that, first of all, there was so much fear you weren't going to read it. It was all, and there was such fear. I thought, you know, we've got to do something that gets people turned out. It makes them excited, feeling upbeat so that they can share the information, bond a little bit, and feel good, feel uplifted. And so I had this dream one night that, because I was in a bit of a rage after Susie died, because I felt her treatment was, everything was wrong. And so had this dream about women, very strong women. They call them warriors now, running, like a, going towards a goal. And the next day when I woke up, I said to myself, this really is a race. It's a race. It's, you know, people are wanting to get to the goal. And that's why we named it Race for the Cure. And we began to use little pink ribbons. Plus, in all of our materials, we started using pink and gray. And then it just caught on, and it became the color of breast cancer. And now, even though people criticize, again, for pink washing, I guess that's what they call it, the fact is, if we don't saturate the public, we'll never get, you know, where we need to be. And if we hadn't saturated the public so far, we wouldn't have the targeted therapies we have now, and all the, you know, the screening and everything that, you know, practically eradicating very early breast cancer, death by very early breast cancer. So pink has caught on, and it's now our color, and the color means not just because it's attractive and feels good, but because it's powerful now. Any other? Yes.
Mine isn't so much a question, but a comment. I just want to express personal thanks for all you've done.
Thank you.
As a survivor.
Thank you.
I too grew up in Peoria, Illinois.
Oh,
I had I stayed there, I would have been in Susan's class. On a bigger level, I just want to thank you for all the money that's been raised for those of us who are here today.
Well, thank you. And yesterday at the race, again, there were so many great people who, you know, who came up and said that and thanked it. And it's always nice for us to hear the, you know, the appreciation from the community. I'll tell you that we have probably a couple of 100,000 volunteers who work for us around the world now. You know, we have a global advocacy or global alliance, rather. We are in 50 other countries, and we have... It's amazing the volunteers who work with this organization, and they're really the people who make this happen, to make the, you know, the heart and soul, our affiliates of Susan G. Komen. So thank you very much for saying that. And I think what was important about growing up in Peoria, and it's not that way anymore, by the way, but, you know, if you roll back time, it was a time where there weren't any community cancer centers. There was no 1-800 numbers, no cell phones, no way for people to communicate. And in my sister's case, her physician told her that she was cured. The surgeon said, you don't have to worry, I've cured her. And I had had some experience. I was living in Texas at the time, and I'd had some experience at volunteering even in those days when I was young for MD Anderson. And I just remembered them saying, you can never use the word cure with many cancers. It's an ongoing issue, and with younger patients, you have to be aggressive. So I knew that it wasn't right. But then the cultural issues were so great, we had a very hard time convincing her that she should go to a cancer center. And it really wasn't until the disease was way too advanced, even though we got her there eventually. So now when you go to towns like Peoria, there are community cancer centers, there are clinical trials, there's all kinds of things that never were before. And the other thing I have to say is that the thing that Susie was particularly sympathetic to is that when we were sitting in the clinic for all these times and days and months when she was treated at the end, we could see the disparities that existed, you know, because MD Anderson being a state, at that time, sort of state institution, not nearly the size it is today, but they were required to accept patients from all over. And, you know, you'd see Hispanic patients coming in, sitting on the floors, and African-American patients, people from the Middle East. We all had to sit on the floor at times because the clinics were so small, and people just surged into the center because they had nowhere else to go. But we could see the disparities, and it just upset her so much to see that, because she used to say to me, it really shouldn't matter how much money someone has or the color of their skin. So our organization reflects that. You know, about half of our budget goes to fund projects for low-resource people, education, screening, some treatment. And that's why we're so committed to that. So, yes?
I wanted
research, not so much the local money and that sort of thing, but how do you choose research? And I understand that out of Komen funds, tamoxifen was discovered.
Right. Tamoxifen, BRAC1, HER2, angiogenesis, the new PARP inhibitors. I mean, we have been, thank heavens, first in every category of funding. You know, when we began, it was monoclonals, which then eventually became HER2. Oh, so, but here's how we do it. And even we've done this from day one, because someone once told me, and I think it was at, I was on the board of UT Southwestern in Dallas, which had a small camp. But I remember one of my mentors used to say to me, it matters how you raise the money, but it matters just as much how you give it away. And it doesn't matter how small it is. Make it the best research you can afford, which meant find the best scientists, believe in them, invest in them, and grow them. And that's exactly what we did. And our early scientific review committee, I wish you could have seen. I mean, there were six people around a dinner table arguing over $50,000. I mean, just brutal arguing. And finally, we decided with some, we were very lucky. Our very first, one of our top advisors was a fellow named Dr. Mill McGuire from San Antonio. And he was a very important breast cancer scientist. He died some years ago, sadly. And there's a giant conference now, one of the most important breast cancer conferences in San Antonio named after him. But he was a little bit contrary, and Bill would sit there, and no matter what anyone said, he'd shoot it down. And I used to think that it was just trying to direct the science his way, but he really wasn't. He was very thoughtful. So we gave the funds, and we didn't have a lot to give away the first 5, 6, 7 years. You know, and finally when we got to the place where we were giving away $250,000 and then $500,000 and then real money to us, which was $1 million or $2 million, we became even more focused on the kinds of, and the first, say, 15, even 20 years, very focused on cancer biology. And that's why, because we really wanted to push out and fund scientists who could determine what strategies in the future could be used to develop therapies. Also, even very early on, we've been funding prevention. This last year, we gave some grants to Silent Spring, for example, which I noticed was in one of the newspapers, to look at some of the environmental factors. And then we funded causation. We funded a lot of basic science, but what we do now is we won't fund any more basic science because we feel there's a lot of knowledge, but has to have a translational piece. There has to be a translational scientist on the Promise grant, particularly the large grant committees. So, well, how we do it is this. We select a group, a scientific advisory committee of what we believe to be some of the best scientists around the world. We entertain grants. They come back and advise us. The board votes on it. And sometimes we generally agree with what they do. But sometimes there are people who, you know, that we kind of say, well, you know, that's not quite what we want to do. And now we have appointed this year 50 scientists to a new board called the Scientific Advisory Board. And they are scientists who, in many cases, again, we've helped build their careers. And some are a little new to us. And what we expect from them, and they each get a stipend, is the best thinking that they can provide. We want new, big ideas. And so we're giving larger and larger grants all the time because we believe in large grants. And we believe in grants that give people a chance to prove themselves. So, and there's a lot online about it in Komen.org if you'd like to see it. But we're going to be leading from our health sciences going forward. Liz Thompson, who has been head of our global sciences, has now been appointed president. And she is extremely, she has a very close partnership with Eric Weiner from Harvard, who is our chief scientific advisor. And we're very, very excited about where this is going. Thank you very much, and thank you for coming tonight.
That's all for tonight's Author on Tour. I'm Darren Fode, and we have been podcasting live from the Tattered Cover Bookstore in Denver, Colorado. Authors on Tour Live has been presented by Belco Credit Union. Belco has been serving members' financial needs since 1936. visit www.belco.org/authors.asp to learn more about how Belco can help you. Stay pod tuned in the coming weeks for many more authors as we podcast Authors on Tour.